From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Moments ago, Senator Al Franken stood in the Senate and spoke of how, as a champion of women's rights, he'd been excited about the national conversation about sexual harassment, and then the conversation turned to him and allegations from years ago.
Nothing I have done as a senator, nothing, has brought this honor on this institution. And I am confident that the Ethics Committee would agree. Nevertheless, today I am announcing that in the coming weeks, I will be resigning as a member of the United States Senate.
Eight women have now come forward to say that Franken groped or forcibly kissed them. Yesterday, the majority of his Democratic colleagues in the Senate asked for him to step down. Minnesota's Democratic Governor Mark Dayton will now name a replacement. Let's get more from NPR's political reporter Jessica Taylor. Jessica, tell us more about what Franken said.
You know, for some, he's been accused of these women, but he was defiant in a way. He said that he remembered some of these instances very differently, or that some of them didn't happen. And he also pointed out the irony that he is stepping down while both President Trump faced multiple allegations of sexual assault during the campaign, and then Alabama GOP Senate nominee Roy Moore in next week's election has also been accused of sexual misconduct and sexual assault.
Well, in fact, we have some of that sound. So let's just listen to a little of that.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
And yet, Jess, he is, resigning in a few weeks. Why, given that he said these things?
I think that it was clear that he lost the support of his Democratic colleagues when so many more of these women came out and when he was accused of doing these things. When you had two-thirds of the Democratic caucus yesterday come out and call for his resignation, I mean, this was a very swift, coordinated call because many women senators were calling for him first, and then Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer, Dick Durbin, the chair of the DNC, Tom Perez, all called for him. We have seen Democrats really sort of fall in line more in this, too. I think that the sexual assault it's clear that it's not a Democratic problem. Or a Republican problem, but he is the second member this week to step down following longtime Michigan Democratic Congressman John Conyers as well.
Yeah, well, some on the right are asking why the call from Democrats didn't come sooner. The Bradford Files on Twitter writes, "Dear hypocrites, you call on Al Franken to resign the day before he is resigning. Heroes, no political hacks." And that's with the hashtag FrankenFondles. But then you mentioned the president and Roy Moore. There's also the Republican Texas Representative Blake Farenthold. It's been revealed he paid $84,000 out of that taxpayer slush fund to settle a sexual harassment claim. The former communications director who lodged it told CNN she was told her career would be over. So you have Republicans not responding to the claims, Democrats who are. Is there maybe also something of a long game, perhaps, with this no-tolerance approach?
I think that we will certainly see Democrats point out that, okay, when we had members that were accused of this, we did maybe eventually, because this person is correct, the Democrats were slow to an extent. You had Nancy Pelosi, for instance, as soon as last week, was still defending John Conyers in some instances, that they did call for him. So I think that Democrats see that going into 2018, an election year, especially where they look to take back the House and even possibly make gains in the Senate, they want to point toward, okay, we're trying to get our caucus in line. Contrast that with Republicans, where the RNC went back in this week spending for Roy Moore, who has been subject of many of these allegations against teenage girls.
Yeah. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton will likely name his lieutenant governor, Tina Smith, to this vacancy. Then there will be an election. But Hillary Clinton only won Minnesota by about 40,000 votes in 2016. Might they lose a seat?
Well, certainly it's a headache for Democrats because they are on defense largely across the Senate. So this is a seat that they didn't expect to have to defend. One important thing to point out about her, she was Dayton's chief of staff, who then became his running mate. And the reason that he's expected to pick her is because she doesn't have any interest, we've been told, about running for the seat. Mm-hmm. So she would be a placeholder essentially until next year when there is a special election, where there will be, I think, a very competitive primary, especially on the Democratic side, for that seat. So that sort of doesn't play favorites in a way of picking anyone. I think that Democrats have bigger headaches probably in terms of seats where they're defending, because they are defending plenty of places where President Trump did win, like Ohio, mm-hmm. Florida, and West Virginia, North Dakota. So I think those are certainly bigger headaches for them. But to add a seat where you now have to worry about is not what they wanted to do, certainly.
Jessica Taylor, a politics reporter for NPR, on another big day and a string of them. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, now to the wildfires in Southern California. Officials have raised the wind threat level to purple for the first time ever because they're predicting 80-mile-per-hour winds. Here's California Fire Chief Ken Pimlott.
These will be winds that there will be no ability to fight fires in this kind of wind. This will be about evacuations and getting people out from in front of any fires that start during these conditions.
Joining us now is John Sepulveda of KQED. He's in Ojai between Los Angeles and Santa Barbara. And John, that's one of several communities in Southern California that are now being affected by the Thomas Fire in Ventura County. What are things like there today?
Well, air quality-wise, it's like living in an ashtray. There is literally ash that's falling from the sky. It looks like there's snow on the ground. It's so white. It smells like a barbecue gone bad. But there is a minor miracle, because the flames that at some points were shooting up hundreds of feet into the sky did not extend into the valley that houses Ojai, the city that I'm in right now of about 7,500. I don't know why these flames did not advance, but imagine like a horde of people showing up at your house and it looks like they're going to come storming in and then they just turn around. For some reason, it could have been the firefighters. It could have just been dumb luck. These flames at one point seemed so explosive and so ready to consume this town. And for one reason or another, they didn't come into the city. So it's a minor miracle this morning.
And what about the winds? What are the winds like today? We heard there that the state was raising the threat level to purple due to the predicted 80-mile-an-hour winds.
Yeah, so purple, it was funny. I was talking to a fire crew member yesterday, and they never even heard of that category. So, you know, red is always kind of been considered the highest. Right. So these are super winds we've never really dealt with. And right now, there is absolutely no wind. And last night, we had wind gusts. There's no doubt about that. But it was not in the range that we were anticipating. The winds were actually much quieter, at least where I am at, than they were the night before. So these winds, which, you know, seemed so concerning last night, they didn't really materialize. Now, that does not mean we're out of the woods. There's, again, as you said, the concern about the so-called super winds that could be coming. But as of right this minute, I mean, there are birds chirping. If it wasn't for the fact that it looked like a ashen snow globe falling, you wouldn't even know that there's necessarily anything wrong.
What about the bigger picture? You joined us yesterday from another location dealing with a fire near the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. What's the status of the fire that's closer to the city?
Yeah, the one that's closer to the city right now, there have been some hot spots that have broken out in the Bel Air neighborhood. But for the most part, it's been contained. It looks good. I was speaking to a fellow NPR editorial employee a little bit earlier. And they said that, you know, because they have to drive that way to get into NPR's building in Culver City. And they said everything looks pretty calm and normal comparatively to where it was yesterday, where it looked like people were driving into a hellish Armageddon landscape. So that doesn't mean people are out. And I know that there was one person in particular I spoke to. I've been waiting to hear if she could go back to her home. She lives in that neighborhood there on the west side of Los Angeles. And she still has not been allowed to go see what has happened, if anything, to her home. So there's a lot of concern. There's a lot of worry. But there's not the same amount of danger that we saw just 24 hours ago.
And still a lot of evacuations going on?
Yeah, hundreds of thousands. And there might be more. Again, these super winds, these so-called purple warning winds, they could spread embers as far away as San Diego County, as far away as San Bernardino. This is like, you know, from New York City to the end of Connecticut. Think of it that kind of distance. So a lot of ground could be covered in a very short time because of the potential wind threats. So there could be even more evacuations. And it should be noted that at least as we were seeing these evacuations, at least one good section of the highway, the 101 in Southern California, has been closed because of these fires. So a lot of traffic, a lot of commute problems, a lot of congestion, and there might be the possibility of even more evacuations.
And do firefighters have the resources they need to fight these fires? Are they even trying to stop the fire from spreading at this point, or just to protect homes?
You know, part of the strategy yesterday was just to let things burn and make sure people were evacuated. because we've had this almost seems miraculous stall of the spread of this fire, they have been able to focus on protecting homes. And they've really looked at that as a strategy, that if they can protect one home from catching, that will lessen the chance that other homes will catch. And then, you know, the fire won't advance into the city core. And I saw that this morning around 2 o'clock in the morning, there were firefighters going home to home, figuring out which homes would be best to kind of fortify to keep this fire at bay. So as far as the larger resource question, you ask the firefighters, they say no. You ask the firefighter unions, they say no. You ask the local firefighters, they say no. You ask the guys in charge, they say yes, they have the resources necessary. So I think it really depends on who you ask.
That's John Sepulvedo with KQED joining us from Southern California as the fires continue there. John, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
The country's first private high-speed rail service is opening this month in Florida. It'll go from West Palm Beach to Fort Lauderdale and will expand to Miami early next year. It could go to Orlando in the future. The trains will run on new tracks built alongside existing freight tracks. Joining us now is John Rennie, who is director of the Center for Urban and Environmental Solutions at Florida Atlantic University. He is outside in West Palm Beach. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And are you surprised that this is finally happening?
No, it's not a surprise. It's been in the works for quite some time. And honestly, I think the project is kind of inevitable in some ways. We have a lot of traffic congestion in South Florida. I went to Miami last week for a meeting, and I literally spent 5 hours commuting to and from Miami in a car. Traffic was just absolutely terrible. And so I think a project like this is very welcomed and timely.
And how long would it take you to get to Miami once this train finally opens all the way to Miami?
From West Palm Beach to Miami, once you get on the train, it will take 60 minutes.
Wow. So why do you think that it actually is happening now? Because this has been tried a lot in a lot of different places around the country, people wanting to have a high-speed rail connection, and it hasn't worked out in the end.
Well, it's the first time that it's happening being built by a private company, and that company is incorporating real estate development at the stations. And that's kind of a game changer for this type of model. It, believe it or not, was the kind of thing that happened back in the 1800s and early 1900s in the United States. But at one point, you know, probably around the 1920s or 30s, we began to turn all of our public transportation providers over to the public sector. And when that happened, we lost the connection between the development around the stations and the rail service itself. And we started building a lot of parking lots around the stations. And when you start building parking lots around the stations, it disincentivizes people to use it, because once, you know, they can't walk to the destinations, they have to drive. Once they're in their car, they might as well just, you know, drive the whole way. Of course, we also didn't have as much traffic back then as we do now, and that's another significant difference.
But you're saying that the private developer here is kind of hedging its bets, because if it can't make enough money on the train itself, maybe it can make enough money on the real estate that is next to the stations.
Typically, the research shows that the transportation service itself rarely makes a profit. It can in some circumstances. But when you combine the real estate and development opportunities with the transportation service, you can actually get to a very profitable outcome.
What kind of opposition did this project face? Because in other places, like in Texas, where they're trying to build a high-speed rail line from Dallas to Houston, one of the problems has been every little tiny town along the way wants to have its own stop, which sort of defeats the purpose of a high-speed connection.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And so when you're a private company, you don't have to be as concerned with pleasing all the local municipalities along the way. But in terms of opposition, most of the opposition has come from people's fears that they're going to be sitting at the rail crossings with lots of trains, you know, going up and down the corridor each day. The train line is already in operations as a pretty busy freight corridor. I live a block and a half from it, and there are very long freight trains that are over a mile long that go through that corridor all day and night. And so people are already accustomed to having to wait. The difference is that these trains are going to go fast, and it doesn't take more than literally 10 or 15 seconds for the train to go by. So there will be slightly inconvenience moments where people will have to wait at the crossings, but it's not very long, and I don't think it's going to have a major impact on traffic.
Do you think that this project finally opening is going to spur other places to work on their own privately funded high-speed rail projects?
I have to say I think so, because the reality is that the freight lines have this potential to service passenger trains, particularly in congested metropolitan regions of the country, and they could potentially build housing if they do it themselves or work with other developers, because most of these same regions that have high levels of traffic congestion, like South Florida, also have affordability problems with their housing. Housing is super expensive. So when you build new housing in these particular locations, they are in high demand from the people that want to live close by.
By the way, we've been using the term high-speed rail. It's not really high-speed rail the way that you would talk about high-speed rail in Japan or China, is it?
No. And it's funny because in Japan or China, the trains go, you know, almost 200 or more miles per hour. Here, you know, the trains are going to max out at 120 or 130 miles an hour between West Palm Beach and Fort Lauderdale into Miami, will, I think, be about 80 miles an hour. But ironically, they call it higher speed rail, even though it's slower than the high speed rail we see overseas.
So the state of Florida didn't have to put money up for this project, but do you think that it'll benefit from it?
Absolutely. I think everyone's going to benefit from it. I think the certainly the local economies around these particular station areas are already benefiting from it. I live in West Palm Beach, and the downtown West Palm Beach is absolutely flourishing with activity. And a big part of that is the excitement and anticipation that in the next, you know, months, you're going to be able to get from West Palm Beach to Miami in 60 minutes. That's just not possible today.
You think a lot of people are going to commute to work in Miami?
I think some people will commute to work, but I think it's going to attract business travelers. You have a lot of tourists that will want to go between Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach, and Miami. And certainly you will have a significant segment that will use it as commuters.
That's John Rennie, who is director of the Center for Urban and Environmental Solutions at Florida Atlantic University. John, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, Bitcoin is reaching new highs, and the economically troubled nation of Venezuela is taking note. The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, said on Sunday that Venezuela will create its own cryptocurrency. That's in part because, as reporter John Otis tells us, Venezuela is running out of cash.
I first realized there's a cash crunch when I try to exchange U.S. dollars for Venezuelan bolivars. Caracas money changers tell me that bolivars are hard to come by. That seems odd, given that the currency is one of the world's most devalued. On my earlier trips to Venezuela, people were eager to get rid of their bolivars. But somehow, in Venezuela's upside-down economy, the nearly worthless banknotes are suddenly a hot commodity. That's apparent at banks like this one in downtown Caracas. A long line of customers forms well before the doors open at 9 a.m. One woman explains that the daily cash limit at ATMs is 10,000 bolivars. That amounts to just 12 cents. She's hoping to get a bit more from a bank teller inside. Another person in line, retired athletic trainer Jose Pino, says the paucity of cash hurts the elderly.
pero no, no le llega la remesa, y si no tienen remesa, no te pueden pagar.
He says banks are so short on paper money that they are sometimes unable to cash monthly pension checks. Analysts blame economic blunders by President Nicolas Maduro's socialist government, leading to what some now describe as hyperinflation. As a result, there's not enough cash in circulation to keep up with skyrocketing prices. The central bank has introduced higher denomination bills, but the new banknotes are printed in Europe, and the government lacks the money to import enough of them to meet demand, says Caracas economist Jean-Paul Ledens.
Prices are doubling every 2 months, so at that rate of price increases, you can't keep up. I mean, even if you start importing bills, there's no way you can keep up with inflation.
President Maduro blames bankers, whom he claims are smuggling cash out of Venezuela in an effort to sabotage the economy and bring down his government. Even so, he portrays the country's predicament as progress.
Que la utilización de moneda física vaya siendo ya sustituida como...
In a recent speech, Maduro pointed out that many advanced nations are moving away from cash and embracing electronic payments.
Que el 90-95% de lo...
He proclaimed, by next year, we want 95% of all transactions in Venezuela to be electronic. That's already starting to happen. Cash is scarce. Customers at this newsstand whip out credit and debit cards for the smallest purchases, like cookies and gum. But so many Venezuelans now pay with plastic that internet connections for card readers often collapse. Also, the system is no help for more than half of all Venezuelans because they lack bank accounts. I finally managed to change $40 for bolivars, and for a fleeting moment, I feel wealthy.
This is the bag of money I was given. It must weigh 2 or 3 pounds, and if I stack up the bills, the pile will reach about 2 feet high.
The catch is that these are 100 bolivar notes, each worth less than a penny. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Caracas.
And it's estimated that Americans spend as much as $150 billion on sports events every year, and a Supreme Court case could cause that figure to rise considerably. In 1992, then-New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley, the former basketball great, helped enact a law that banned sports betting except in states where it already existed, Nevada, Delaware, Montana, and Oregon. Now the court is considering striking that federal ban, and the challenge comes from New Jersey, where lawmakers approved sports betting in 2012, prompting a lawsuit filed by the major pro sports leagues, and that's now before the court. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. He joins us now. And Mike, NPR's Nina Totenberg reports on Monday the justices signal they may be prepared to strike down this federal gambling ban. We'll link people to her reporting on the case. But from your sports view, what would that mean?
Well, she bases that on the questions that the justices were asking, and it was a little surprising to some that the justices even took this case, and they thought that New Jersey's attempt to legalize it was going to be over. What it would mean to the leagues, the sports leagues, even though they've perhaps confusingly come out against New Jersey's specific interest in the case, what it would mean is a windfall. And the NBA has really led the charge on this, correctly, I think, arguing that a game between Sacramento and Minneapolis, the Minnesota Timberwolves, might be of no interest to someone in New York unless the Timberwolves were giving up four and you could put money on it. And once that is legal, then it would increase interest in the game. Plus, the leagues themselves would presumably have a cut of the ways to bet, and they would say it's a win-win-win for everyone because the states would get some cut of the money. I suppose part of the win is the estimated 10% of people who can't help but become addicted to gambling.
Well, but there's another concern. I mean, I thought that part of the lawsuit from the pro teams was that it would hurt the integrity of their games. That you know, it's like the old stories that we hear that players would be, you know, induced to throw a game.
old stories, I think that is an apt phrase, because there was a time when perhaps you could imagine a guy with a pinky ring and a limp going up to an NBA player and offering a couple thousand to throw a game. But now that salaries are in the millions, I don't see that the mob or any gambling interest would hold sway over a professional player. The NCAA is another kettle of fish, and they have come out against the ban. And I think that they are on less shaky grounds, although someone could charge them with hypocrisy, because without the madness of the March Madness brackets, how many people would actually watch the NCAA tournaments? What the leagues really want is not a state-by-state solution. They want a national solution to this, and they'd like to make money. And I should also say the NFL stands apart a little bit from the other leagues. They're more of the league that's talking about integrity of the game, and yet the NFL did approve the Raiders' move to Las Vegas, did they not? Not that Las Vegas is synonymous with
but it is
perfidy and gambling, but it is called Sin City. Exactly.
Yeah, there you are. Just real quick, we have a half minute. Where are we in fantasy football? Is that gambling or a game of chance? Where are we?
The NFL, fantasy football, rotisserie baseball. So the NFL contends that it's not, because it's gambling on individual performances, not teams. That is a fine parsing. What it is very remunerative for the NFL, and it doesn't seem to have hurt integrity at all.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. We should disclose, I think you play it. I host the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
New research has once again called into question the success rate of the U.S.-built Patriot missile defense system, which has been sold to countries around the world to shoot down incoming missiles. You might remember last month, Saudi Arabia claimed to have shot down a ballistic missile fired at the Riyadh airport by Houthi rebels in neighboring Yemen. You might remember last month, Saudi Arabia claimed to have shot down a ballistic missile fired at the Riyadh airport by Houthi rebels in neighboring Yemen. President Trump bragged about the strike from Air Force One. But arms control experts who studied the debris say the Saudis missed. And later, U.S. officials told the New York Times that there was no evidence that Saudis hit any part of the incoming missile. Jeffrey Lewis led that research team, which studied debris and photos from the strike. He's with the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. And Jeffrey, you and your colleagues shared your research with the New York Times. We'll post that at herenow.org. But walk us through the evidence for saying the Patriot system failed. Start with the debris that fell from the sky. There's video and photos of it. What did you determine that was?
Well, the debris that fell in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia. And we were actually able, from descriptions of where it fell and some of the videos, to locate it. It was about 12 miles south of the airport. And when we looked at the debris, it was really a curious thing. You know, the point of destroying a missile is to blow up the warhead, the part that explodes. But there was nothing in the debris that suggested the warhead had fallen there. It was really the rest of the missile. And that was very curious to us, and it led us to want to investigate further.
Okay, and so what you found then was video footage of people at the airport talking about there being a loud bang, an explosion, and then other video of people looking at some sort of crater or something. What was the next step?
Yeah, this was very curious, because if the missile fell in the capital, well, we wondered what exploded at the airport. And so there was definitely a video of people in Terminal 5 saying, oh, there's an explosion, and they were all walking over to one side to look out the windows. And then there was a still photo, and there was a video looking down the runway, and you could see at the end of the runway there was a kind of dark cloud coming up. And it seemed that what had happened was the missile fell in Riyadh, but the missile warhead separated and came very close to striking the airport.
Which is not uncommon, because the missile body, that tube, is supposed to propel a warhead forward, but often can what, just come apart because of the speed and the force?
Yeah, there are really two possibilities here. If you fire a missile 1,000 kilometers, which is how far this missile traveled.
About 600 miles. Yeah, go ahead.
If you fire a missile that far, what will happen is the force of reentry will tear the warhead off. So usually, actually, the warhead will be separated deliberately.
Well, and there's also a possibility that the tubing for the missile body, came apart, the warhead continued on, Or perhaps the Patriot missile, the defense system, did shoot down the tubing part and missed the warhead. However, you found the Patriot batteries. Remind us what they are and what their trajectory told you.
Yeah, so there is a missile defense system called the Patriot. It's the same system that the United States used in the 1991 Gulf War. It's been improved a little bit, but it's really fundamentally the same system. And this is really one of the most interesting puzzles of the whole thing. There are news reports in Saudi Arabia showing cell phone video showing five interceptors, missiles that are designed to shoot down missiles, launching from this location. And we were able to look at the video and determine where this was happening. And it was happening from a site that's right next to the airport. But it's a really curious thing, we have to say, because there are some satellite images that would suggest that perhaps there was no missile defense system at all there that day. And so we wonder, perhaps the system struck the missile body. Maybe it just missed and the missile body tore up. Or maybe they didn't shoot at all. But the one thing we're certain of is they did not intercept that warhead.
Well, you say maybe they didn't shoot at all. In the Times article, unless I'm reading this wrong, there is sort of a mapping of the trajectories of mm-hmm. each of these things we've talked about. There's the estimated trajectory of the missile body. You can see an arrow coming into a box and heading towards the ground. Above that is the estimated trajectory of the warhead. It continues on further. Mm-hmm. Between them, the missile defense, suggesting that the missile defense missed the warhead, you know, it's below the warhead, and was slightly above the missile body. What was the evidence for that possibility?
If they did fire, the location that they fired from is between where the missile body fell and where the warhead fell. Then, of course, the other piece of evidence that leads us to think it's possible that they shot is just from looking at the damage to, I guess, what's now being called the tube, the missile body, where there's a lot of damage to the lower part, where the engine section is, but no damage up at the top where the warhead would be.
Yeah. Look, what are we to take from this? Both the Saudis and President Trump said they took down an incoming missile.
It's not true. You know, we've seen this time and again. I think one of the most frustrating aspects of the debate about missile defenses is there is, I think, a tendency from governments to simply assert that they worked. And every time that we have taken a really careful or close look, whether it's the performance of the Patriot in 1991 or looking closely at the tests that the Missile Defense Agency has done or now looking at this case where there's this claimed intercept, you know, we tend to find that the truth is rather more disappointing. And so, you know, I think that what is happening is governments want to say that they have an answer, that they're being responsible and that they're capable of protecting their citizens. And the last thing that they want to admit is that their populations are vulnerable to missile attack. And so in a situation like that, it's pretty typical for governments to say they shot things down that they didn't.
Well, and that's pretty scary. You mentioned the Gulf War. The Times writes that, you know, the U.S. claimed a near-perfect record in shooting down Iraqi kind of Scud missiles. But analysis afterwards found nearly all the interceptions failed. And here you're saying, you and other researchers are saying, this claim in Saudi Arabia failed. We know that North Korea is developing its nuclear-armed missiles. Do you feel any, moral responsibility not to broadcast to North Korea, to the Houthis in Yemen, that in fact these systems don't work?
Well, this was the argument in 1991. You know, the United States had said they had a 100% success rate at the beginning, and then when experts started looking at it and the House of Representatives launched an investigation. My understanding is that privately U.S. officials were saying, please don't publicize this. It doesn't help anybody if you tell the bad guys. But, you know, I'm a big believer in democracy. You know, I look at it the opposite way, which is I think our government has a responsibility to be truthful to us. And I'm a scholar. And so I am focused on being responsible to the truth. You know, we should make informed decisions about our national security based on facts, not lies.
Well, meanwhile, the contractor Raytheon builds the Patriot surface-to-air defense missile system, and the company's international chief executive, John Harris, told CNBC just last month that it's a growth market in Europe. Let's listen.
I would tell you, as a direct result of the threat dynamic that our customers are seeing, they want to have the ability to protect their sovereignty. The Patriot system, the world's only combat-proven integrated air missile defense system, is the only system that they can that is available for their capability and their needs.
Jeffrey Lewis, first of all, is it really the only system, and one that you've and others have pointed out doesn't work all that well?
Well, it's hard to know how well other systems work. I mean, generally speaking, my experience is when we start peeling back the layers and looking more closely, all of these systems struggle. And the reason they struggle is this is really pretty tough because, you know, you have to get super close and you have to make sure you detonate the warhead, not just hit the missile body. And that's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. How close did the Houthis get to the airport in Riyadh?
It looks like from satellite images collected the day after the attack by a company in San Francisco called Planet Labs that the warhead fell right at the end of one of the runways. So it was a few hundred meters from an area where aircraft are, and it was just about a kilometer from the terminal itself. So, you know, close enough that people could hear the explosion, look out the window, and see the smoke rising.
Yeah. That's Jeffrey Lewis of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey in California. He led the team that says the Saudi claim that it shot down a missile using the Patriot missile defense system is just not true. We'll link you to more at herenow.org. Jeffrey, thank you.
My pleasure.
Today, clashes broke out between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians during protests against President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The announcement reversed nearly seven decades of U.S. policy. It's seen as a victory for Israel and a blow to Palestinians. The Palestinian group Hamas has already called for a new intifada or uprising. Neri Zilber and Gaith Al-Omari are fellows at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. They join us now. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And Gaith, let me start with you. What was your reaction to this announcement for President Trump?
This announcement has put the Palestinians and the Palestinian president in a politically untenable position. He has been involved with the Trump administration in trying to relaunch the peace process. Right now, politically speaking, it's very hard to see how he can do that.
Why do you think President Trump made this decision?
I believe it was a purely domestic calculation. If you look at the speech yesterday, it was classic Trump. He said, I'm different from previous presidents. He said, I keep my word, my election promises. And that was basically it. It was a domestic political calculation with very little foreign policy rationale, to my mind.
Neri, what do you think? And how are Israelis reacting today?
Well, I agree with Laith. I think the impetus was purely domestic, if not personal, for President Trump. Obviously, in Israel, there is a widespread celebration across the political spectrum. There's been longtime support for the U.S. Taking such a move, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Having said that, the celebrations have been somewhat muted, perhaps through the directive of the Trump administration, not to crow so publicly about this very significant victory for Israel. And also, I think there's an understanding of the consequences on the ground for and stemming from this move.
Well, we're already seeing protests and clashes. Gaith, do you expect things to escalate?
The test will be tomorrow. I have very little doubt that tomorrow things will escalate, but how much is the real question? Friday is always a tense day, and what we will see tomorrow will be a good indicator of how things will play out in the next couple of weeks. But there's no doubt that there will be clashes tomorrow.
You say Friday is always a tense day. It's a holy day.
It's a weekly mass prayer. Right. Most Muslims go to mosque, and this is where people congregate. And this is traditionally where demonstrations start from.
The New York Times columnist Tom Friedman was on CNN yesterday, and he called President Trump's decision a giveaway. He said that Trump should have used the U.S. embassy location as a bargaining chip with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Let's listen.
Trump could have come to him and said, Bibi, you want the embassy moved? That's really important for you. Here's what I want. I want you to announce a ban on any more settlements beyond the settlement blocks in the West Bank for two reasons. One, that will preserve the possibility of a two-state solution at maximum, and at a minimum, it'll preserve the possibility of separation between Israelis and Palestinians, so we won't have...
Neri, what do you think of Friedman's argument there?
Well, I'm not usually in the habit of agreeing with Tom Friedman, but that's absolutely right. This was a giveaway by Donald Trump to the Netanyahu government for a transactional president, for a deal maker, as Mr. Trump likes to see himself. This was pure victory for the Israeli side without the U.S. and U.S. interests receiving anything in return.
You think he could have gotten something in return if he had tried?
I think he should have at least tried. It's an open question, really, what's going on behind the scenes. There's speculation that he might come down hard on Netanyahu in the coming weeks, if not months, in the context of a renewed push for a peace process. But right now, this possibility, I would say, is pretty remote, given the realities on the ground right now.
And Gaith, do you think that Palestinians would have accepted this move by the Trump administration if they had gotten something in return?
Most certainly. I mean, it would not have been an easy sell, but if this was done in the context of a peace process, of a peace plan that showed the Palestinians what they have to pay, but also what they get to gain, it would have been easier to sell it. Right now, it's that it has put them in a corner. Look, if you're a diplomat and someone who's into parsing words, the president left yesterday enough wiggle room for the resumption of negotiations. The question is political. Is there a Palestinian or, for that matter, an Arab leader who in the short term can engage with this administration? So diplomatically, we had a chance. I'm afraid we might have missed it for the time being. Things might stabilize in a few months and we will have a new chance. But right now, I don't see any progress.
Do you think it's possible that this was a negotiating tactic in a long game for a peace deal?
I would have made that argument had we actually had a timeline for a launching of a peace process. What we've had over the last few months is talk that Mr. Kushner, President Trump's envoy, is working on a peace deal. There is no timeline for presenting this proposal. There is no process. You use pressure, you use leverage when something is ongoing. When nothing is ongoing, leverage is wasted.
Neri?
Yeah, I agree with Raith. I think the most vexing question coming out of President Trump's speech yesterday is why now, obviously, and also what is there for the U.S. to gain vis-a-vis the broader Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the renewed push, really, declared already since the beginning of the Trump administration for the ultimate deal, as Trump calls it. So if that's the objective, why take the step that they took yesterday?
That's Neri Zilber and Gaith Al-Omari of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Pleasure, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.